Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by 127games.com, home of the cheapest Access and Allies miniatures. Find them at 127-games.com.
Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I am your host, Jonathan J. Reinhardt. This is the podcast for you if you are interested in historical or New England gaming. This is episode 81, and I am delighted to say that I am joined by the one and only Mr. Brent Newell. Brent, how are you?
Doing fine, thank you. I think you forgot to mention long-standing war game designer,
yes.
Brent Newhall, because I'm here with my only game.
Well, this episode devoted to your game Tabletop Conquest,
yep.
Which according to my printout was last updated on 2008.
Thank you so much. That's yes. So that was a slight. So for those of you who might have a copy, and it is free on Wargame Vault,
we'll have a link in our show. Head on over to wargamingforums.com/WR81 to get the show notes.
There we go. I released it in August of 2012. In of course that's 08, 2012. So my brain said that was 2008. So for some reason I typed 2008 in like every version of this thing that I've uploaded. And no, it's not 4 years old.
Did something really good happen in 2008?
Not that I know of.
You make like $1 million or like, I don't know.
I wish. I don't know. It's funny. I think it's one of those things where just the brain farts. And one of the things I try to do on these things is look over them a lot and pay attention to numbers and making sure things look good. But, it's one of those things where the brain just refuses to see it.
So why don't you tell us what Tabletop Conquest is? I've talked about it a little bit before and I lost track whether it was this show or Geeks Explicitly or whatever, but I talked about it a little bit before. But why don't you tell us what is Tabletop Conquest?
Sure. So the long and complex backstory, basically, and I'll try not to make it too boring.
It is an hour show, though, so you get the time.
That's true. So back when I was 8, I had a dream that I would one day write a one-page war game.
Dream! It's so specific.
I know. It's amazing. I knew when I was 8 years old, I would one day make a PDF. PDFs didn't even exist then.
You invented the term.
Exactly. And I wrote it down, and then apparently Adobe stole that from me. I do a lot of traveling for my job, and literally I was sitting in a hotel room, and I wanted to play some kind of game, and I do have certain geek tendencies. I happen to carry a D6 with me in my pocket everywhere. So I had that, and I was looking at that, and I'd recently finished reading a book called The White Company, which is, get this, a historical fiction novel set during the Hundred Years' War about this military company written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Ooh.
Exactly. And he considers it to be his best work, and I kind of have to agree. It's amazing.
Did you just insult all of the works of Sherlock Holmes?
Pretty much. No, I adore Sherlock Holmes, but as a, it's one of those things where it is long, complicated, many characters, very easy to read, amazingly, readable, but, the characters do lots of things and very real. You really feel like you're there. And I mean, much as I love Sherlock Holmes, they're very much these, magazine stories, and then there's these little short things. So he just was able to do a lot more in this book. And I just finished reading that, and so I was tempted to play a little bit of another game that I had come up with about a year ago based on somebody else's design called Three Dice Dungeon, where basically you roll three dice and that determines what room you're in, whether it has a monster, and what treasure's in it. And then your old dice determine your statistics and use those to fight the monster and so forth. And I think of playing that, but then I was like, I want something that's a little more tactical. So I just finished reading The White Company, and I decided, wouldn't it be interesting to have a little dice-based game, which is randomized, but where you use the dice to build up something of a map as you go, and then that map has certain strategic elements to it to determine, okay, you know, if I go here, that will have this effect. If I go there, that'll have that effect as I'm trying to go towards a goal. So it's basically a game where you start out by rolling to determine your current territory and surrounding territories on like a grid. You use a point buy system to build your army, and then you move to different territories. That territory can have will affect your army. It may have another army that you have to fight, and you're trying to go and find an enemy capital. And once you have a certain number of squares on the board, if you will, then the capital now has a chance of showing up. And once you get to the capital, now you have to fight another army. So it's, and again, sort of inspired by the Hundred Years' War, very, very broadly. And that's the basic idea.
I think your game hates me because every time I play it, I lose. So either it's a conspiracy or I just really suck at your game.
Or I just am bad at designing war games.
No, I'm sure it's not. I really am a bad player, so it's probably me.
Well, no, it gets to an interesting point, I think, about war game design is that war games especially need so much play testing, and the numbers are so important. And something I hit with this is that when I went in to design, and normally when I design role-playing games, you can be, you can basically come up with an idea, have an idea for a mechanic, and throw down a rough mechanic, and then let playtesting sort that out. You know, so the number may be 4 or 6 or whatever, but you'll figure that out in play. With something like wargaming, where the numbers are so intricate, it's very easy to unbalance the game with only a few rough ideas. You have to be a lot more careful about the math.
I was thinking about this book that I covered, oh geez, what was it, episode 76, mm-hmm. Wally Simon's Secrets of War Game Design. And Wally, known for all his different wargaming designs, and he has he's passed on, but he had reams and reams of notes on, you know, different ways of trying to come up with his own wargame rules or adapting other rules and trying one thing and not liking it and, you know, playtesting. And he really was evidence of like what you're talking about, how wargaming, you get something down and even when you think you're done, you're probably not, that someone somewhere is going to find something and be like, I'm sorry, this, you're just wrong. It doesn't work, or it's too complicated for me. That's probably something I'm likely to say. This is hard. Let's make it easier. I want to play a bunch of games. So it's not easy to get all this kind of stuff in there. And I mean, you look and you think, Tabletop Conquest, okay, cool. It's a one-pager, it seems really succinct and well-written, and then you play it, and I'm not saying that anything's wrong with it, but I'm just saying, like, you play it, and then I might play it, and someone else might play it, and we might have different experiences with it.
Yeah. It is really hard. I mean, one of the things I aim for in, especially games like this, where it's more of a casual pickup game, you don't want it to be a game that's really hard. You know, unless that's really what you're going for, generally speaking, for pickup game. You know, you want the player to be able to play for at least a fair amount of time. So it shouldn't be one of these games where, okay, turn one, you're dead. Turn two, you're dead. And so finding the right numbers to make it so it's not intensely frustrating, so that, you know, 3 or 4 turns in, if you mismanage things, you're completely screwed. I think that's one of the really, you know, key things. And it also gets down to the question of what you're randomizing. I think that's one of the most interesting questions, is figuring out, okay, what's random, what's not, how are those things distributed, what choices can the player make at certain times? That's where things get really complicated.
Well, I think it's interesting looking at your rules. In different parts, you break it out in different ways, where sometimes, depending on what you're rolling for, a 4 and a 5 give you the same result, and sometimes a 4 gives you one result, a 5 gives you a different result.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really tell how you were playing with the different probabilities and trying to determine, you know, exactly how likely you want something to come about.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, in a game like this where, you know, you're rolling a d6 every time. And there's that question of, you know, 1 in 6 chance is actually fairly small. And when you've got lots of different possibilities for what each of those roles can mean, that's a pretty wide spread of possibilities. One of the reasons why in games like D&D in the role-playing, you know, world, they have that nice D20 number, and you're usually going up against a, you know, a 10 or a 15-ish kind of a difficulty, because you're, you know, there's a decent chance of hitting that kind of a number. So figuring out those, and in fact, we've seen it also in a lot of indie games where you're focusing more on, you know, multiple dice and having one of them roll a certain thing, stuff like that. So having a game where it's just, okay, if you roll one on a D6, you get this, two, you get something completely different. That makes the game a lot more swingy and thus, you know, again, harder to design.
I know some people who would say that perhaps I guess they're a little confused why D6 is the, like, most common kind of dice, because you figure you roll it, each side is almost 20% probability, and that can be a lot, or it can be a little.
And honestly, I think damn cheap to make. I think that's the simple reason. It's a cube, you can, you know, churn out dozens of them, and so Milton Bradley just loves the hell out of them. because, you know, a lot of these other dice make a lot more sense. It's one of the reasons that I like systems like Fate and things like that, where you have, you know, you're rolling multiple dice and then looking at distribution curves.
Yeah.
I think that makes a lot more sense in terms of saying, okay, now you're going to do slightly more, slightly less damage or things like that, as opposed to, you know, you might do none, you might do a billion. And those are kind of both equally likely. And that's less fun.
Well, I think the strength of the D6, too, and this is one of the reasons why I really like that you use it for tabletop conquests, is if you're a gamer, if you're a war gamer, chances are you have a D6 on you or near you at almost any given time. So if you're like you're stuck in a hotel room somewhere and you want to pass the time, you can probably reach in your pocket or go in the luggage, or, I mean, you could go down the corner store or whatever.
Yeah.
You could buy a D6 pretty easily and just pop it over and be like, let's see, who am I going to kill tonight?
Right. And, you know, any given home is going to have, you know, a copy of Monopoly or Yahtzee or something they can grab a die from. And I'm a big fan too. I think if our hobbies, want to attract a larger audience, there's a need to be aware that the fact the larger audience doesn't have access to D10s. And, you know, much as we wish that they had all these different things, you know, making games that do have that possibility, I think, opens it up more to folks who say, oh, all I need is a D6, I can get one of those, I can play this game. Maybe they won't like it, but at least you've, you know, made something available to them.
So when people are playing the game, like, the first thing, and maybe I'm wrong, but the first thing that they do, they look and they say, I got a certain amount of points, I have 200 points I need to spend to create my army. And so there's different types of units, aren't there?
Yes. So there's infantry, archers, and knights. Infantry costs 1 point, archer costs 2 points, knights cost 4 points, and you have a total of 200 points to spend. And so you'll end up with, they're basically grouped into an archer unit, an infantry unit, and a knight unit. And so you have different numbers of those. And then one of the things actually I got from feedback, which was interesting, is that folks said basically, and again, to make this easier, can you give us something to start off with? So, in the second draft of the rules, I threw in some sample armies. So here are a couple of different, sort of loads that you can work out with those numbers. So you can have, you know, 100 infantry, 26 archers, 12 knights, things like that.
Do you have a recommended, you know, composition for the army?
Not so much, other than the fact that going really wild one way or the other ends up being difficult because of some of the other rules, which can kind of kill you pretty quickly if you have a very small unit on one end or the other. So basically, the way the mechanics work, we'll get to that more in a minute. But you know, obviously, infantry, lots of them, they can do a fair amount of damage, but they get killed in large swaths. Archers kind of in the middle, and knights on the other end, where they just do massive amounts of damage, but they can get killed fairly easily. So, you know, you gotta kind of keep that in mind. So, you know, that said, one of my principles in design is to leave things open to the players as much as possible, and to say, you know, it may be really fun and really interesting to try an odd kind of composition and see where that goes.
I remember seeing on your G+ page that someone was playing with this, and they're like, you know, I win all the time. I have an army of all knights. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
That's going to work. And I said, okay, well, do you know what? I'm going to try that. And then I tried it and I lost. I lost like on my second turn because, like you just said, if you go on all knights, they're 4 points each. You're not getting very many of them. So you're going to take a lot of damage and then there goes your unit.
Right.
Yeah. Although this person, I don't know how the heck it happened, but when they were rolling for their territories, they kept on getting marshes. And if you roll a marsh, you add 2 knights to your army. So every turn, you're adding 2 knights to your army, which means hopefully as long as you take less than 2 knights casualties per turn, you're gaining size of your army. And like, I don't know how they got it because a marsh isn't an easy thing necessarily to roll for, or at least it wasn't for me because I kept on getting mountains.
No, it's a, you know, a 2 or 3 on a D6. So, you know, that's not great odds. But again, that gets back to the whole randomness of the game. And part of the design of the game came from a board game that came out in the '80s called Mystery Mansion, which, apparently has this following on Board Game Geek of people who just, you know, would pay thousands of dollars for this game. They love this game. Because it came with these little cardboard, squares that had rooms in this house, this big mansion. And so you'd flip them all over and start the game in the foyer, and then you'd pick one up and it would show, you know, the library. So you put that next to the foyer. And then you go move to the library and do your searching for mystery clues. And you pick up something else and that would be, you know, the kitchen. And they had probably 25 different rooms. Turns out people would basically not bother playing the game. They just design mansions. they just say, okay, we'll put this here, and this, and then, you know, we don't want to go too far to get to the kitchen. And, you know, it's one of the interesting things about a game like this is when you have a game where the different territories you can enter have an effect on your army, do you make that more deterministic or do you make it completely random? Because if it's random, you can get completely screwed. And depending on your strategy, or do you let that affect your strategy? It's all, again, part of the complexity. One of the, you know, the ways that the rules work is that once you set up your army, then you roll for the different territory that you're on and all around you. And so I think on a 1, it's water, 2 to 3, it's a marsh, 4 to 5, it's plains, and 6, it's mountains. So that kind of determines what those are, and each of those, improves different units. So again, you have kind of this question of, should that be random because that kind of forces the player into certain things, or you let the players decide that in some way, in which case now the players have much more control over being able to game the system. It's a tough one. I don't know.
It is a tough one. I'm kind of amazed that, like how you were able to just begin and create the roles, like getting that traction together and, be like, I'm going to start here and let's try this and try that. That's a big hurdle to overcome.
Yeah, it you know, and the luck was I was bored in a hotel room. so I was kind of sitting there saying, well, I'll try this. And I knew I wanted, and I think it's one of the helpful things in game design in general, is to start with a clear idea in your mind of what the game will actually look like in play. It may not actually look like that in play when you're done, but I knew I wanted a map on a little scrap of paper of different, you know, territories that I had sort of moved through. And I knew I wanted to be able to sort of trace my path, you know, through this land, to some destination. So I knew I needed to have some kind of way of having land there. And of course, you're going to have land that might as well have some effect on the game. And, you know, having only one kind of type of land is kind of boring. So that, you know, determined that. And then if it's going to be a, you know, inspired by the 1 year war, there's got to be some fighting. So you throw that in there and, that determines other things about the game. One of the things, I wanted, in the game, getting back to that question of how easy it is to pick up is I didn't want one of these games, which I tried initially where, okay, you roll to see how many you hit and you roll again to figure out damage. And, you know, you can have lots and lots of roles in these things, and it turns into this sort of, this complex simulationism, which is great for a game that's more detailed, but something at this high level, you gotta find something that works reasonably well. So the way I worked it is simply you choose 1 unit to attack, You roll to determine the enemy unit. So 1/2 is an infantry, 3 or 4 are archers, 5 or 6 are knights. And then you basically have, there's a multiplier for each unit type. And that determines, how many units of the other side they destroy. So infantry against infantry don't do too much, but knights just clobber things. But the disadvantage is that you have lots of archers against knights, for example, then those archers can just annihilate the knights, or infantry, indeed. So, that makes that simpler, but it also makes the game, simpler. So, again, it's one of those trade-offs that you don't get quite as much tactical complexity.
One of the things that I have long been curious about is that the different types of terrain provide bonuses for your army. And I was curious, what made you decide what type of bonus went to what type of terrain?
Guessing.
Because, for example, marshes, we mentioned, add 2 knights to your army. Plains, you increase your infantry level by 20%, you round down for anything. And mountains, you increase your archers by 20%. Why do mountains give you more archers? Why don't they give you, I'm not going to say more knights, because obviously horses on a mountain don't make sense. But, how do you come up with that?
So part of it, honestly, came from, the board game I developed, Zeppelins vs. Pterodactyls, which happens to have, jungles, forests, and mountains. I think that was just in the back of my mind. But, also, again, reading White Company, that's the kind of sort of territory that they had moved through. So I knew you had that kind of thing back then you had to deal with. So, the plains, I figured, you have, settled areas. You're going to have lots of normal sorts of fighters there, folks who can do normal infantry stuff. For mountains, and actually the marshes, this is so embarrassing. Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I built this castle in the marsh, and then it fell down. So, knights, obviously. And then mountains, I think originally those were knights because mountains, the idea is you have, your mines and your metal and things like that. And so for archers, you need that for your weaponry or for, the forests on the side of the mountains with that. But really it was the fact that I needed to have knights in one, infantry in another, archers in another. And then I had to figure out some numerical advantage. And then just making it 20% for each one is, again, kind of dull. So I decided that, knights, because you generally have very few of them, adding just 2 knights allows you to, increase quite a bit if you have few knights, but not too many. So your knights, you're never going to get really, really, really big based off of that. But with the plains and the mountains, you can build up your infantry and archers pretty quickly.
Well, then that leads me to the next big question.
Mm.
Now that I know this is still kind of a work in progress, it's finished, but you're still adapted and stuff.
Sure. Yep.
Do you intend to release any sort of expansions for it?
I wouldn't mind. It's a fun sort of design, approach. I really like these small games. I like games where, you only have one sheet of rules. You can sit down with a little notebook and play a quick game. I'd love to do something that is a little more tactically rich. I'd love to do a game that is a little more predictable. It's hard to balance everything in any game like this. It'd be nice to sort of expand it, have other enemy types, territories, things like that. I think if I did though, I'd need something other than a D6.
That's true. Well, because, for example, I've looked in, the different territory types. Mm-hmm. I've thought, say, forest might be nice, or I thought you could easily adapt this to other time periods. You could adapt it.
I guess.
You could even adapt it instead of basing it on land, right? It could all be, you could do naval warfare.
True, absolutely. Space.
Space. You could do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, you could do 3-dimensional battles, too. That'd be cool. Good luck putting that on your piece of paper, but whatever.
Well, there's a lot of paper craft kind of stuff.
True.
And so you could test your artistic hand at designing some paper craft stuff or, work with someone to get little tiny paper, paper strips, paper, whatever worked out. And you just print it out.
It's like Car Wars.
Exactly.
And I was actually surprised to find out that Car Wars is basically a war game. And people look back on that as being sort of this kind of quasi role playing game. But no, really, it's, you know, you soup up your cars, you figure out where they're going, and then you do this very turn-based thing of them attacking each other. And, you know, one game is typically about 5 or 10 minutes worth of real life time, and someone's, you know, car flips and explodes, as happens. So, you know, and it's all little paper miniatures, literally. You're just moving around, and it's like, okay, this one's moving at this speed, so you're slowing up and or slowing down and speeding up. And, I think that'd be a lot of fun. I'd like to see something like this expand to something where you could actually, play. I think a two-player variant would be interesting too.
Well, I brought this to the, I guess it was the recent timeout. Some of my buddies and I, we get together maybe like once a month and we play historical games. Mm-hmm. And so I brought this with me and I was like, you know, I got this game for you guys. It's free. You can get it online. And cool. They're like, free and online? We like that. And I was like, it's on War Game Vault. One of them is a big fan of War Game Vault. He spends lots of money on there. And I was like, it's really cool. It uses a D6. It's medieval and it's a solo war game. Mm. All you need is a D6, something to write with, something to write on, and the piece of paper the rules are on. I was like, I will send you a link and send it to you, whatever. And I brought it and I thought, this is really cool. And then I thought, oh, if only we could play this together.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing that. That's a very interesting idea. I mean, one of the sort of drawbacks to the game is the fact that there needs to be some way of randomly determining what the bad guys are. And so the way I have it is, you know, sometimes there's none, sometimes they're bandits, sometimes there are these certain armies. And that actually gets an interesting thing that happened is that originally, you know, when you roll to determine if there are enemies in the territory you've moved into, you roll and okay, it's a small army, medium army, large army. And the problem is, you know, your strategy then became pretty well set. So I added the idea of bandits where once you roll bandits, you then have to choose the enemy, the unit you're going to use to attack. But then, when you actually start that skirmish, then you roll to determine what the enemy's units are. So you have no idea what you're going up against. In terms of size of force and things along those lines. So that kind of made things a little more unpredictable. And, you know, makes the game a little more fun when you're going against bandits. So you have these sort of smaller but less predictable foes and these larger, more predictable foes. But when you have a game where you have multiple players, you have the advantage that, okay, no, everyone's keeping track of that stuff. And so you can really go for it and then kind of build that over time. I think it would be a lot of fun too to build it where everyone gets together. This is what I do with the Zeppelins vs. Pterodactyls game is that you start with the, I think it's 36 tiles for this sort of lost world you're exploring. And you hand those out and folks just start laying them down. And so you have, okay, I'm going to put a mountain here. I'm going to put water here. And I'm going to put marshes here, so forth and so on. So you sort of collaboratively build the landmass on which you're playing the game, which I think is a lot of fun.
That's kind of like, do you do like hidden reveal or does everyone know what is going to be out there?
So the way that game works, you know what the tile is in terms of whether it's water or mountain or whatever, but every tile has some kind of treasure or loot or equipment or something on it on the underside. So, you know, you don't know what is actually on that tile until one of the Zeppelins flies over it and then you flip it over to find out what it is. And different types of tiles have different, distributions of things. So you'll have more cannonballs on in the jungle and more, you know, more armor in the forest and things along those lines. So you have some idea of sort of probabilities of what you're getting yourself into. And if the mountains are all clustered together, okay, I know there's a lot of treasure in the mountains, things along those lines. But you don't know exactly what you're going to get on any given tile.
Okay. It's kind of like, well, at least in the tile aspect of Carcassonne.
Yes, exactly. And you know, in that one, it's more of an exploration game where you're flying your Zeppelins around and uncovering treasure and different equipment and trying to fight off each other and their dinosaurs that, of course, on a lost world. so they're dinosaurs that you have to fight off as well. And while you're trying to keep up all your armor and all that kind of stuff. So sort of this resource management game. And so the fun there is that you have, you build out this map, which you're going to explore, and you'll probably end up going over different territories and different tiles several different times. So getting a feel for what's there and what you may want to come back to, things like that, makes the game a little more rich and interesting. Whereas a game like Tabletop Conquest, it's more, you're kind of moving through all these territories until you've laid at least 20, and then the capital can come in and you can attack the capital and win. So there's less of a need to go back over territory. Again, it gets back into the whole question of game design of, do you make a rule or make a reason for folks to come back to a territory? Do you have the ability to find more archers, whatever? So that is part of the complexity of game design. It's just, there are always new things to think about.
I think with Tabletop Conquest, you could really, I think you have something awesome here where it's very light, it's very accessible and portable, so mm-hmm. that you need very little and you can play it for when you're on the go or whatever. But I think you could mm-hmm. also have, like this light version, and then you could have a version of it that has maybe a little bit extra, that has, mm-hmm. maybe it comes with a map already. And I think that'd be awesome. Yeah. Like, it could just be graph paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that way people just have to write in. They roll for each square, and they just write in what it's going to be. Oh, I'm in this square, and I rolled plains, I rolled mountains, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they move around so that you could add some extra functionality and maybe make things a little bit easier by increasing some components.
Yeah.
So that if someone needs the light version and they're going on a trip or whatever, mm-hmm. they take the light version if they're going to play at home or whatever. They can use the one with all the little extra gadgets and stuff. And then maybe even price them differently. Like we talked about, this is free right now anyway, as of the recording on Wargame Vault. But then maybe if you're going to be adding all these other things, maybe if you're going to be adding extra functionality or expansion packs and stuff, or adding a grid or whatever, mm-hmm. maybe you're going to charge like $1 or something like that.
Absolutely. I think, games are certainly worth their wages. And, I think that's a great idea. I'll certainly have to look into that. I mean, like you said, I think that there's a lot to be said for games that are, lightweight and portable, and that you can just sit down and enjoy and play around. The other thing too, I think, is that, it's important with small games like that to approach them from the perspective that we're approaching them, that they are these fun things you put together. And absolutely, if someone were to sit down with this game and play it obsessively, like for an entire weekend, they're going to find, significant number flaws in some way of getting around things and do it. And that's fine. These games are fun ways of sitting down and just sort of testing your mettle against the odds and the numbers and seeing how good you are. Why not? It's a fun thing.
I think with wargaming, especially with historical wargaming,
mm.
there's these two kind of camps that mm-hmm. don't always get along about it. And some view it as it's a simulation. You need to very accurately duplicate the historical situations mm-hmm. down to, exactly like what they wore and what they ate and everything. And then I think all the way on the other spectrum, you have the people who are like, let's just really make it really accessible and easy and fun. It's kind of like the beer and pretzel versus, whatever type of game. And so there was this game out, and it's still out there. Wizards of the Coast put it out. Of course, they're owned by Hasbro. Mm-hmm. It's called War at Sea. It's part of the... Do you ever play Axis and Allies, the board game?
I have not had a chance to play that, no.
So it's part of the whole Axis and Allies universe. Wizards is like, we got this board game. It's awesome. Let's mm-hmm. make a minis game. So they made these miniatures there. Mm-hmm. Pre-painted, pre-cast, whatever. And it's mm-hmm. World War II naval gaming.
Ooh.
So there's this online message board. It's a really cool message board. The Axis mm-hmm. and Allies Forum Mini. Great group of guys. I'll have a link in the show notes.
Great.
And I used to be on there all the time on their message board talking about stuff or whatever. And they're probably still to this day, but there used to be a lot of discussion, a lot of debate about the game and its historical failings. And people would say, well, is it a beer and pretzel game? Is it a historical game? Which is it? And I used to be like the lone person who'd be like, well, do you know what? It's kind of both. It has a little of this. It has a little of that. And I think it leans a little more towards the beer and pretzel aspect, but that's cool because then that makes it something that people are going to approach. And if they like, then they can use it as a jumping off point to play something more in depth and maybe to learn more about the well, the war and all the different ships and stuff. Like, we don't need to get it entirely accurate that, like, the firing distance or whatever. People complained in the game, right? The game uses these pre-printed maps, foldable maps, and your ships, they move, like, you know, one or two squares, and then you shoot, you can shoot up to three squares away, depending on what it is. And people would complain that, like, a battleship, for example, you got more dice at square three than you did at, or am I getting that wrong? You got more dice up close than you did further away. And they said you would actually have the, you know, the greatest firepower in that mid-range because the shells are arcing. And if you're right next to the battleship, you're not going to be hitting. But, of course, the people weren't realizing that the scale of the game, that although a grid is whatever, the grid space is whatever, it actually represented a vast distance. But all these kind of debates would happen. Should they, was this color paint scheme that they painted on? Is that in, you know, I can understand, understand wanting to get things to be like whatever. Sure. If you're representing Waterloo, right? You want to make sure that the units are wearing the right stuff or whatever. But not every game has to be that way. And I think there's maybe that kind of schism in the historical and in the wargaming kind of world.
Sure.
I think some people think, well, that's what you get if you're wargaming. Whereas if you're gaming, it's not as serious. It's not as prestigious as wargaming. So that's where the Baron Pretzel games go through. And people might be like, well, that's where Tabletop Conquest goes through. It's a game. Yeah. It's not a wargame. But for me, a wargame doesn't so much mean that. It's what it's depicting. It's a game that's depicting this conflict, that's depicting some sort of historical sort of aspect about it.
And I think it's an important point that there's a lot to be analyzed in any of these things. I give this presentation at anime conventions a lot where I talk about the history of anime, and I start off by saying history is a lie because you know, how can you possibly take, you know, the Battle of Gettysburg as an obvious example with all of the men involved, all of the support, you know, the weather, the terrain, you know, all of the leadership, their training, their equipment, you know, all those various things, and sum it up in a high school history textbook in, you know, a paragraph, much less a book. And there's just no way of getting all of the detail that is actually relevant to why, you know, this leader failed in doing this and capturing that hill. It's just, it's really, really complicated. And I think that there's also a lot to be said for games that, simulate certain parts of a conflict. I think, you know, when you get, and I'm no expert, but I think once you get into, simulating a war, you need to figure out what level of detail you're simulating it at. You know, Tabletop Conquest, for example, is this very high level, very light, game, which says, okay, here are the kinds of units you're going to be working with. Here are their, here's an idea about what they're doing. So you can kind of get into the concept that when you don't have vehicles, when you're dealing with these sorts of things, here are the overall sort of strengths you're working with. And I think that's valuable. I think it's valuable to say, okay, we're going to be really, really, really accurate with troop movement and with this and with that. And, you know, you can certainly do that. But, I remember there was a role-playing game that came out a while back, that was post-apocalyptic. And, they try to have this really, really specific, really accurate damage thing where, like, if you were hitting a vehicle, you would roll to determine, you would have to determine the entire internal geometry of the vehicle to determine what your bullet was passing through and what it was hitting and how much damage it was doing to each of those things, which was great. But you fire, you know, a weapon at a vehicle and it takes 10 minutes to figure out what happens. And, you know, again, it was a level of simulation that was inappropriate for that game at that time. So I think, you know, you got to figure out what you're going to approach and what is worth simulating and what isn't. And, you know, I really hope there's a place for those very detailed simulations. We need those. We need those games that say, okay, no, here accurately are, the difference in size and damage output and all these sorts of things, these weapons. We need that. And we need other approaches as well.
I was actually, while we had been talking about Tabletop Conquest, I was thinking about this computer game I used to play back, like, it feels like a gazillion years ago. And I don't know, maybe you played it too, or maybe some of the listeners have played it. Castles 2? It was out on the Mac and, you ever play that?
I have played some version of it, yes.
So, Castles 2 and Tabletop Conquest, to me, kind of similar in that, well, obviously because they cover in the same time period, but like in Castles 2, for example, it has this kind of, I'm going to use the term casual, but I don't mean it in a negative way, because I think it gets tossed around like negative games too casual or whatever.
Yeah.
But it kind of has this kind of casual approach to it where it's very introductory. It allows you to do certain things, but it's not as in-depth and detailed for stuff because that's not its intention.
Yeah.
It's trying to get you in so you can, you know, go around and you do these different things and you have some options, but not too many. And you play around and you're moving around on the map and you're doing stuff or whatever. But then comparing it also to a more modern game, which is in some ways still kind of a little casual, but I think a lot more detailed, would be Medieval or Medieval 2, part of the Total Warfare series, I think it is. Yeah, they have Shogun and that might not even be the name of it, in Shogun 2. Total War, I'm sorry. It's the Total War series. They got Empire, Total War, and all that. But Medieval and Medieval 2 Total War, the updated version of it, it's kind of like they took Castles 2 almost, and then they added more depth. Whereas in Castles 2, you have a province, a territory that you own, and you interact with others. In Medieval 2, they added more depth where more involved diplomacy, and you actually control what type of buildings and things you are constructing in your territory, and what type of units you're getting. So it's not just like an archer or whatever, but there's crossbowmen, there's longbowmen, there's veterans of those, and then, and you know, as you use them more, they get more experience, and so then they become better and better, and then as you build like an armory or other things, so then their equipment gets updated, their armor, their weapons, and so forth. So like Castles 2, just like Tabletop Conquest, it provides that really accessible approach where you can get in and you can have some fun. And then if you want like a more detailed kind of simulation, and I hate to use the term simulation, it would be like playing Medieval 2 where it has more stuff, but they're different types of games, and yet they're really good for the different types of games that they are.
Thank you. I agree. And I think also it gets down to the kind of game you want to play. Tabletop Conquest is not trying to specifically accurately simulate, medieval warfare on that level, even in terms of the relative power of infantry versus archery, for example. What it's trying to do is to give the overall feel of that. And, and doing that with certain mechanics that allow you to get a feel for, sometimes it's overwhelming, sometimes it's impossible, sometimes it feels easy and you have to, to work with things. And I think there are some games that are more about the mechanics. Some games that are more about the simulation. There are some games that are more about the world and the reality and getting a feel for what it was like to live back then, or what it was like to wage war back then. I remember playing a Civil War game a long time ago, and I apologize, I forget its name, but there was a lot of time spent getting your troops into position. And it was boring as hell. And that's what it was like in the Civil War, getting your troops into position. It just took forever to get these people out to there. It was one of those things where this is part of what we're getting you to understand, that this is, how you do things. And it changed the tenor of the game. And so I hope there's room for all of that in gaming, and that we can all find the games that work for us.
I think there is. There's different types of gamers, and different types of gamers like to play different types of games. And maybe if you're, like a quote-unquote serious war gamer, you need a little downtime. You can't be involved and knee-deep and all this kind of whatever. Or you want to step back and give yourself a little breathing room and, play something that's going to be of interest to you, that, still accessible and fun, so that you can do, and you can be like, that was really cool. I spent, however long doing it, and now I can go do whatever else and stuff. I mean, you can't always take those really involved games with you with all their hundreds of pieces and all your... I look at my miniatures for stuff, and I mean, I got tons and tons of other things, and just carting those around, it takes me like two or three trips sometimes to bring all the stuff out I mean, if you're going on a trip or whatever, can you imagine getting that through airport security? All that lead and metal. I'm sorry, sir, your stuff's causing some problems with the x-ray machine. I mean, you can't do that, whereas you get something like Tabletop Conquest or whatever, where, you know, it's here, it's on paper, it's easy to do. And
yeah, just got and that's very much my approach with this. And it's also, I think it's down to the idea that there can be games out there that don't work for people. I mean, I run into this with anime fans a lot too, where, you know, there's this idea that if I didn't like it, thus I'm never going to recommend it to anybody. And, you know, maybe that isn't for you. Maybe it's not your kind of story, and that's fine. You know, when I'm talking to folks about what kind of shows they, you know, they would like to watch, I don't always recommend them shows that I particularly like, because I know that I don't like shows about 14-year-old boys learning valuable lessons about growing up. But a lot of 14-year-old boys really do, especially when they're punching each other's guts out. So I'll absolutely recommend those if I see, you know, the appropriate quality in them, even though I'm not going to watch that show. So I think for something like Tabletop Conquest is one of those things where, you know, you download it, you look it over, and maybe something that, either will work for you as a one-off, as something to, you know, carry in the binder and pull out when you have some downtime, when you want to spend 5-10 minutes playing something, or something where somebody says, you know, I'm interested in these war games and these sorts of games, but I'm not really ready to, you know, plunk down however many dollars on one of these games, or I'm kind of intimidated by the simulationism. Well, here's something that can kind of get you in.
I think it's very important to know your audience. So, for example, I know all of you guys listening, and girls, I know there's some girls who listen to the show, listening to this don't know this, but Brent and I recorded an episode for my other show, Geeks Explicitly, earlier, and we talked about sci-fi shows, and I would never, ever talk about sci-fi on here, like, not on TV shows, like, gaming, I would perhaps, because it, my audience here, you guys who are listening, everyone who's listening, are into this for the gaming and all that sort of stuff, and the wargaming and the historical New England kind of thing. Whereas on Geeks Explicitly, I would never ever talk, like last week I talked about playing Civ 4 on the Mac. I wouldn't talk about, well, maybe I would, but I'm just thinking, like, I'm not going to talk about wargaming stuff on Geeks Explicitly.
Right.
Because the wires cross and the different types of audiences. So just like I need to know what I'm doing for what show, the gamers need to know what kind of games they like, and if you don't know, it's important to find out, and then play those kind of games, and of course, be open to other games and trying things out. And with something like Tabletop Conquest, where it's really easy to get, and it's free, there's no reason to not get it.
There we go. And actually, let me throw out a little recommendation. Something that I set a challenge for myself last year was something called, my 50 games in 50 weeks challenge, where I decided I would play 50 games that I'd never played before in the following 50 weeks. And, so I played role playing games and board games and card games and all sorts of different things. And, part of it was just because I wanted to have more exposure, but I realized after that I became much more conscious of the kinds of games that, I play and I love. I can play, but I don't love. I love, but I can't play. in just different genres I never really thought of trying out that I found out that I really enjoyed. Others that I thought I would really enjoy that I didn't. You know, there are lots of these little, abstract, dice games out there where it's, you know, you're rolling these dice and then adding, and there are a lot of these very numerical games, which just don't do too much for me. And, you know, you find that out. So I think it's very valuable to say, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to just try a bunch of different things and explicitly try a bunch of different things and find out what works and what doesn't. And fortunately, we live in a world now where we have such access to all these things. It's not just, you know, the contents of your local gaming store are the only games you will ever see in your life. I mean, that was reality 20, 30 years ago. And now with the internet and cons and all these various things, there's just so much exposure. You know, you go to a con and there'll be a stack of 100 board games, or war games or card games that you've probably, you know, maybe you've heard of, and pull one down, crack it open and give it a try.
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that challenge you gave yourself, because mm-hmm. I will be giving myself a challenge.
Oh, yes.
Where I'm going to be participating in a fundraising event to raise money for Boston Children's Hospital.
So awesome.
All of the money, all the profits raised, the proceeds are going to Boston Children's Hospital to help out children who need medical help, regardless of whether their families can afford to pay it or not. And mm-hmm. There's a lot of kids out there who need help, need assistance, and their families, yeah. they just can't afford it. Mm-hmm. I have a little cousin. She has cystic fibrosis.
Ooh.
And she's gotten a lot of help from Children's Hospital. And I know there's a lot of kids out there who suffer from that and suffer from other diseases who they need the help and they just can't get it. So there's this charity out there and they're doing something amazing. They're allowing people to play games. That's right. You heard it. You can play games for 24 hours and people can sponsor you. You guys can, and I hope you do. You can sponsor me and donate money to this charity and the money's going to go to Boston Children's Hospital. And I will be playing games for 24 hours with Mr. Ben Gerber. He's, of course, the owner of Troll in the Corner. We'll be playing them at his house, playing board games and card games and all sorts of stuff. And so we'll be hanging out and seeing how long it takes for us to get annoyed at each other. And just playing these games and raising money and stuff. And I've told some people about this, and they're like, wait, you're going to give to charity by playing games? And I'm like, yes, I'm playing games, and kids are going to get the help they need.
And just to be clear, like, this isn't Desert Bus. You know, this isn't like painful games. These are fun games.
Yep. We haven't worked out what we're going to play, but all sorts of games. We're part of also the Reddit team for this. Reddit's hoping to raise tons of money for various hospitals across America. Everyone is picking hospitals near them or hospitals that have done things for them. I know Ben has also picked Boston Children's Hospital because of the help that it's given to one of his daughters who was born with a cleft lip. Ooh. And Children's Hospital has helped her so much, and they do so much, but this hospital is all over the place who do so much good for all of the kids nearby.
Absolutely.
And kids travel all over the world to come to these hospitals. They're amazing places, and they get the help they need. So I will have a link to this in the show notes, or you can head on over to wargamingforums.com/charity, and there'll be information there about all of this, and then you can donate online. It's all fully tax deductible and it's 100% secure and, I mean, everything. Reputable charity. And it's a really good cause. I'm hoping to raise $100. Ben was hoping to raise $400 and I know he's already beat that. So hopefully people will be able to participate and help out. If you are interested in doing some of this stuff near you, get some buddies together, play some games, just head on over to the show notes, which you can get to by going to wargamingforums.com/WR81, and we'll have a link to everything, and you can just go ahead and get signed up. So I want to thank you, Brent, for being on episode 81 of Wargaming Forums.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a blast.
And, of course, we'll have a link to your blog and all sorts of stuff in the show notes. And at this time, you guys are all going to be hearing our credits and information about the Troll in the Corner podcast network and just all that kind of stuff. So I want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. And as always, don't forget, keep on gaming. This show is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. If you enjoy this show, you might like some of the other podcasts on the network. Every Wednesday is a new episode of Indie Talks with Troll ITC owner Ben Gerber. Ben chats with people involved with indie games, movies, and much more. Every Thursday is a new episode of Geeks Explicitly, hosted by yours truly. All aspects of geek life are discussed. Wargaming Recon comes to you on the second and fourth Mondays of the month. I chat about historical and New England gaming. Monsters of the Shattered World, hosted by Troll ITC editor Brent Newhall, releases monthly. This story podcast details the adventures of a young scholar encountering strange monsters on a foreign planet. To learn more about the shows on TCPN, visit www.trollitc.com/TCPN.
Hey there, this is Ben Gerber from Troll in the Corner, and I'd like to invite you to listen to my podcast, Indie Talks. Indie Talks is a discussion about independent publishing, where we take a look at indie games, the people who write them, and the people who play them. we're going to branch a little farther afield as well and talk to some independent television and movie stars and creators, as well as crafters, all of who are related to gaming in some way, shape, or form. So please join me on the Troll in the Corner Network at trollitc.com and give Indie Talks a listen.
This is Andreas, Apprentice of the White Order. I would like to invite you to listen to my letters, a humble collection of my observations of the various beautiful and very, very dangerous creatures that inhabit my world. I hope you enjoy it as part of the Monsters of the Shattered World on Troll in the Corner at trollitc.com.
Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the Troll in the Corner podcast network. Visit www.trollitc.com for more information. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 license. Look for Wargaming Recon online at www.wargamingforums.com. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Stitcher Radio. You can learn more about this episode by reading the show notes on our blog. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Thank you for listening, and keep on gaming.